Life Audio.
You are listening to The Becca Cook Show with your host, Becca Cook. For more information about Beckett and his ministry, visit his website at beckettcook.com. To help support the podcast, visit patreon.com/The Becca Cook Show. Please consider subscribing to the podcast and leaving a 5-star rating.
Hey guys, welcome to the show. Today I have a special guest, Bruce Venata, and he has an incredible story he's going to tell us. He was crushed underneath a semi-truck and basically died and came back to life, and he's going to tell us all about that experience. It's amazing. But first, a word from our sponsor.
What impacts you every day? There is one book that influences almost every aspect of our lives. Museum of the Bible reveals the Bible's impact on your favorite musicians and artists, the way we measure time, social justice, our national monuments, and more. The Bible's impact is all around you. Discover how at museumofthebible.org/impact.
But look around you. Your family, your faith, they're not in the way. They are the way.
From the creators of Jesus Revolution comes the incredible true story.
It's going to be dangerous and scary and giving up. It's not an option.
The story of one family's journey from down under to center stage. Unsung Hero, a For King and Country film starring Candace Cameron Bure and Terry O'Quinn. In theaters now. Visit unsunghero.movie to learn more. Rated PG. Parental guidance suggested.
Welcome, Bruce.
Well, thanks, Beckett. Thanks for having me on your show.
So glad you're here. Your story, I saw it recently, and I just was blown away by it. I mean, the fact that you're going to tell the story. So why don't you tell us what happened in 2006 to you and how, you know, you were crushed basically by a semi-truck. So tell us that story and what happened.
Okay, so it was a work-related accident. I owned a business where I did diesel repair on site. There's diesel engines all over the place where people have to have somebody come work on them rather than take them to a shop. So I had a mobile repair truck with all my tools on it. And we based it out of our home here, the business, and I would just travel around right in the middle of Wisconsin. So one day I might be working in a gravel pit. The next day I might be working on a generator at a hospital. That particular day I was working at a logging business, working on a big, large logging truck. The brand was a Peterbilt. This was as big of a semi truck as you're going to see anywhere. It's class A truck. And so you picture a big rectangular implement garage. That Peterbilt logging truck didn't have any logs on it. It was empty. It was backed all the way into the back of the shop. And so for 3 days, I would drive an hour south of my home here, drive, you know, that down there, and I'd work on it all day long. And so the third day was November 16th, 2006. I got on job site, left here at 6 a.m., got on job site at 7 a.m. We worked on the truck all day long to finish it up. It was the end of the job. I was called in because the truck had a coolant leak. It was an antifreeze leak. It was a pretty detailed repair. We had to take the cylinder head off, replace the cylinder head gasket. We put a reman cylinder head on it. I worked with another guy, the mechanic that actually worked at that logging facility. So a lot of times the customers would call me in to do these repairs because they didn't have the tooling or the special tools or special training to do the engine repairs. So that's what I did, was an engine repair specialist. So I was there. This guy, you know, he was a mechanic. He did a lot of the repairs and he helped me through the job, but he didn't have the tools or the training to do this technical engine job. So we worked the 3 days together. I happened to have known this guy. His name was Leonard. And I had known him since I was young. The day of the accident, I was 36 years old. And when I had met Leonard as a young man, maybe in my teens, when he used to bring his logging truck to my dad's repair shop, and we used to work on it. My dad has a repair facility that I grew up working in, and we used to work on his. Well, he had retired. Then he went to work for his son and daughter-in-law. So he's the guy I'm working with the 3 days. So we get to the end of the job, and I had him start the truck to we're going to run it up to temperature to test the repair to make sure it's no longer leaky coolant. And I'm putting my last couple tools away in my truck, and Leonard comes up, and the only thing left apart on the truck was the passenger side front wheel was still removed and an engine mounted air cleaner. Other than that, the job was completely done. So he's going to come. It's Thursday night. He's going to come back in Friday morning, and he's going to put on the wheel that he had taken off, and he's going to put the air cleaner on that he had taken off as part of helping me in the job. So I'm done. We're just testing it. I'm just about to leave. Minutes from walking out, he comes up, taps me on the shoulder and says, before you go, would you look at one more thing? And I remember I didn't want to look at anything else. I left my house at 6 and I looked up at the clock and it was already 6:10 p.m. So by the time I drive home, I'm going to be like, if I left right then, it'll be 13-hour and, 10-minute day. And I'm thinking, I don't want to work anymore. I'm done. He reads my mind. I'm looking at the clock. I don't answer him. And he said, hey, he said, I don't expect you to fix anything tonight. He said, I just want you to diagnose. He said, so this had a Caterpillar diesel engine. So Caterpillar engines are big yellow engines. And there's a big greasy, dirty spot on the front. And he said, and he could wipe it off within a couple weeks, it would come back. And he said, so I know I'm seeping oil out of somewhere. Just diagnose where the oil's seeping out of. We'll order the parts. Maybe you come back. I'll schedule it to come back later to fix it. Or maybe it's something simple. You could tell me what to do. So that's what I was going to do. I'm just going to diagnose this other leak before I leave. So the truck's still running on these big Class 8 trucks. The new trucks have, plastic bumpers, but these older trucks had usually chrome bumpers. And if you were to get on your knees and look from the front of the truck to the rear of the truck, like say the truck is parked there in a parking lot, and you're to get down your knees and look underneath the truck front to rear, what you'd see is the lowest thing to the ground typically is the front axle on one of these trucks. And the reason why is you got your two wheels that move when you turn your steering wheel, and out of the middle of those wheels, that axle attaches and just goes from the left side of the truck to the right. And it's just a big steel I-beam. And on this truck, it carried between 10 and 12,000 pounds of weight empty. So 5 to 6 tons of weight on the two front tires, big steel I-beam axle. Leonard had placed.
How wide is the I-beam?
Okay, so the I-beam, looking at it like from a side view, it's maybe like this wide.
Okay.
And it's about, this tall, depending on the truck, because the different weights of the truck, the axles are a little bit bigger, a little bit smaller. But in general, they're, a good solid 6 inches deep this way and, 6 to 8 inches tall.
Okay.
So it's a real big steel I-beam, enough to carry 5 to 6 tons of weight. So Leonard had put a jack underneath it. And again, it's about this wide front to back, right? But it's got a little bit of round radius. He put a bottle jack underneath it on the passenger side, jacked it up, removed the passenger side wheel so we could get access to the engine. Jacks are lifting devices. They're not supposed to be used to hold weight. Unfortunately, he had left the weight on the jack. And instead of using jack stands or blocking to take the weight off the jack and then rest it on a jack stand or block, that's the way you do it normally for safety. He didn't. So it's been on the jack for 3 days. It's been, the engine's been running like 15 minutes, to make sure the other part is done. And so I looked under there. I saw that it wasn't, I saw that there was no jack stand or no blocks. I saw that it was just on the jack. Again, it's been running, 20 minutes. It's been on there 3 days. We've been going in and out. I mean, I've been working from the top. He worked from the bottom. So there's a tool that mechanics use, Beckett, to go into vehicles called the creeper. And tools are really weird things. So I grew up using tools. I had $100,000 worth of tools on my truck because cheap tools really stink. And I make the joke all the time that cheap tools have caused a lot of bad words to have been said because they're just so aggravating to use. And so a cheap creeper is really bad if you're a mechanic because cheap ones, they don't roll. They won't roll on the floor. Okay.
By the way, so just so we know, a creeper is like it's almost like a skateboard. It's a flat surface with wheels that you lay on top of on your back and you go underneath the truck.
Exactly.
Right? Okay.
Exactly. So expensive creepers have big wheels and, they're caster wheels and they've got a steel framework. So I've got several $100 creeper in the back of my truck right there with a nice 6 wheels and, steel framework and a nice cushion. And the problem with the cheap creepers is when you get on and try to go left, they go right. Though a lot of times the little wheels will pinch your arms. I mean, they're just so aggravating to use. So I looked at this piece of junk plastic. This is important detail, but it's plastic hollow core and mine is steel. And I look at this piece of junk with these little bitty 4 small wheels, 2 wheels on each end. And I had 2 big wheels in the middle as well, 6 wheels with a cross member right where the truck had fallen on me, right? So I'm thinking, I don't want to get underneath the truck on that creeper because I'm probably going to say bad words. And it's like, well, I look at my creeper in the back of my truck and I was like, well, I don't know. I didn't want to take the time. I want to go home. So I just get on his piece of junk creeper. It was a difference between being crushed in half and being literally severed in 2 pieces. Because when I went underneath the truck, so now I go underneath the truck and I'm looking at the bottom of the engine where it's leaking. The truck is still running. And where I happened to stop to see the part I needed to see, that axle that's being held up by the jack over here just happened to be right above my belly button. And like I said, if you're looking underneath one of these trucks, that's the lowest thing in the ground already. But he had jacked it up to remove that wheel. So maybe there was, I don't know, a few inches, 2-3 inches of space between the bottom of the axle and my belly, right above my belly button. So I'm looking at the bottom of the engine, and, you know, I already had a good idea what I thought it was because I'm factory trained on those engines. And I knew what I figured it was going to be. So I'm looking at the thing I think it's going to be. And I yelled out to him. I said, I don't need it running anymore to look at this. So go ahead and shut it off. So I'm laying under the truck, and Peterbilts are known for air suspension. They're like one of the first ones to have it. It's really nice if you're a driver, but these trucks will really move a lot as you get in and out of them or go hit a bump or anything because the back of the truck is in air suspension. The cab's got air suspension. So he gets in the truck, and because of the air suspension, the truck shifted and rocked. It moves quite a bit. He's a big guy, and he pulled himself in, and, you know, he's over 6 feet tall. He pulls himself up in, and unfortunately, he grabbed the steering wheel apparently at some point. The driver's side wheel is still on the ground, connected to the axle. It's going right across my belly, held up by a jack on the passenger side because that wheel is off. So when he got in the truck and it shifted to shut it off, it shifted, which is normal. That didn't bother me, but I saw movement in the peripheral vision of my left eye. And I turned my head just in time to see the jacket slipped off from underneath the axle.
We'll be right back after this short break.
What impacts you every day? There is one book that influences almost every aspect of our lives. Museum of the Bible reveals the Bible's impact on your favorite musicians and artists, the way we measure time, social justice, our national monuments, and more. The Bible's impact is all around you. Discover how at museumofthebible.org/impact.
Hi, everyone. If you've been injured in an accident that was not your fault, listen up. We have legal professionals standing by to answer your questions for free. Call now and find out if you have a case and how much it's potentially worth. Call 800-497-4410. I'm here with spokesman John Wolf. So, John, tell everyone listening who should call right now.
Well, Maria, first off, thank you for having me here. It's always nice to answer the listeners' questions. Now, as far as who should call in, anyone who's been injured in an accident and think you deserve compensation, give us a call right now. 800-497-4410. You'll find out if you have a case and how much it's potentially worth.
Thanks, John. You heard it, folks. Take advantage of this opportunity and call now. 800-497-4410.
Advertisement sponsored by Legal Help Center may not be available in all states.
And it was rocking. And it was like, and it didn't even look like it was touching. It was just like right on that edge. And that's probably why it was rocking, because it's just on like a last 16th of an inch. And then it shot out like a rocket. And that 10 to 12,000 pounds of steel dropped about that far and hit the cement over on that side because there's nothing, no wheel to hold it up. So we hit the cement. Problem was, I was underneath it. So that plastic hollow core creeper collapsed to nothing. Like it flattened out to probably like an 8-inch thick or something, like flat. And the truck fell through the middle of my body, like, and I always say it, like a blunt guillotine, right through the middle, right above my belly button. It clipped a couple ribs on the left side. So I must have been underneath there at just a little bit of an angle, basically right dead center in the middle of the truck. It didn't hit any of the ribs on the right side, but it got two on the left side and the very bottom two. And so when it fell through, it actually broke my L4, L5 vertebrae. So I was, when the truck was on top of me, when this thing fell through, you can imagine this big loud explosion noise of, you know, 10,000 pounds of steel or 12,000 pounds of steel hitting cement. But the craziest thing was, it was like this liquid gurgle noise that I heard at the same time. And what happened was, when the truck fell on me, because it was so wide and it crushed me all the way down, and I ended up 1 inch thick on the left side, approximately 2 inches thick on the right, thinner than my spine, L4, L5 broken. But when it fell through me, blood literally shot out on impact out of my mouth, you know, in a blob next to on the floor over here by my head. And I, at that point, I just called out and I said, Lord, help me. I remember saying it two times. I can just stop right there and say that for anybody listening, I did not grow up, just so you know, I didn't grow up churchy. I didn't grow up going to church, maybe Christmas, maybe Easter. I grew up in a drug and alcohol family. I was physically and verbally abused. I had a rough childhood, and no one would ever say I'm a churchy guy, or, you know, I was never, would have never, nobody ever said that about me. Mm-hmm. And when I called out, Lord, help me, I was referring to Jesus, because I had a couple of times where I'd encountered God in my life and I knew Jesus was real. And so I yelled out, "Lord, help me." And I'm referring to Jesus when I say, "Lord," I just want to say that. And to say that I was never, you know, not like I was no Mr. Super Church guy in my life. So the truck falls on me and I'm crushed in half. And I just said, "Lord, help me." I yelled out to Jesus twice. I don't know if I said it the second time because I was afraid he didn't hear me the first time or what, but I said it twice.
So, and then so it's clear, like the I-beam, your abdomen was completely flat to the ground, basically.
Yeah. And the plastic helical creeper was flattened out. So basically, so that big I-beam that I showed you was only, you know, this wide front to back. It's only an inch between the bottom of it and the cement. So my body and the creeper are in that inch. And on this side, it's a couple inches. So that's why my spine was broken, because L4, L5 were broken because I was thinner than my spine.
Oh my God.
So okay. I was about an inch thick here, about 2 inches thick here. And it's got me. And if I would have been on my snap-on creeper with the steel framework, the framework is an inch thick. So when the truck, that's all there would have been space for that steel with the framework. There's a cross member right there and with an extra set of two wheels right there. So it would have sheared me. I would have been sheared into two pieces because the steel cross member of the creeper would have been a shear point. And it literally, I would have been chopped in two instead of being 1 inch thick and 2 inches thick. So it was life or death just getting on that plastic creeper. And so I'm crushed down. I can't even tell you how bad it hurt. I've got a high pain tolerance. I mean, I raced motorcycles for 10 years, state champion in Wisconsin for several years, broke a wrist on a Friday night, raced a national race in the next day and won. So, I mean, I've got a high pain tolerance, but this was crazy, crazy pain that I can't even describe. It was so horrible. So the truck, the jack slipped. He got out of the truck. He never shut it off, because the jack slipped before he could shut the engine off. So Leonard, now the bumper, the chrome bumper is down here on the cement behind my head on the passenger side, but there's a gap over here behind my head because I'm just underneath the front of the truck. The passenger side fuel tank is collapsed, caved in on the bottom because the whole passenger side of the truck is down. And so Leonard gets down out of the truck and he's looking at me and I'm looking at him. I got my head turned back like this. And he went into shock. Again, I've known the guy since I was young. He jacked up the truck. He didn't use the safety equipment. He felt guilty. And so I'm just looking at the bumper, picture of the bumper between us, and we're looking underneath the bottom of the bumper at each other, and his eyes, I mean, he literally went into shock. So I started as best I could saying, "Leonard, call 911, please." And I could barely talk at all. And I kept saying it, and he was frozen. And it seemed like forever. It was really scary. I don't know how long it was, but to me, it seemed like forever. At a certain point, he snapped out of it. So 2006, I mean, there weren't smartphones, there were cell phones, but there weren't smartphones, I don't think, you know, maybe a BlackBerry or something. But so we got a regular landline on the wall. He calls a volunteer fire department in the middle of nowhere. And because that's as you expect the logging business to be. So he's going to get the jack. And I sort of shut the engine off, because the big vibrating diesel engine, it's the axles right got my vertebrae. According to the radiology reports on my vertebrae, spider cracked and D-shaped. So it's got my vertebrae like this, and it's vibrating on me because big diesel engines vibrate, and it was exaggerating the pain. It was already excruciating enough. And I'm saying, shut it off. So he got in the truck, he shut it off. Then he went and get the jack. But the problem was he couldn't put the jack underneath the axle because the axle's on the cement. So he's trying to put the jack underneath the, you know, he's trying to figure out where he's going to get this truck off my body because the jack is on the ground. So, the axle's on the ground, so he can't put the jack underneath it. So he's trying to figure out what he could do. Well, there's a big curved leaf spring, and that leaf spring is attached to the axle. And he put that jack, if you can picture a side view of the, you know, here's where your wheel was that's gone, side view of the truck, there's a big curved leaf spring. That axle attaches to it, and he put that jack underneath the arc of that leaf spring like that. And you don't ever want to jack something up on a curve. It should be flat to flat. And so I'm saying, no, don't jack it up there. It's because I'm afraid it's just going to slip and fall on me again. And I was already in excruciating pain. And he said, it's the only place I got. And so he's pumping the little handle because it's just a manual jack. And every time he's pumping it, the jack isn't catching it sliding. I'm watching it slide because of the arc. But then it finally, the arch, you know, and then it finally caught on a little edge of a piece of steel. So he starts jacking it up. And finally, he jacks the truck up off my body. And it is literally barely touching on the edge of this end of this bracket on the short piece of leaf. So the jack is barely touching. I'm terrified. I'm going to shock. And the weirdest thing was, so when he jacked the jack up, which pulled the axle up off my body, now I'm able to see my body for the first time. The first thing that happened was, as soon as he got it off my body, this incredible, horrible weakness took over. And we found out later from the doctors, it was because I had major artery severed in five places. So as soon as as long as the axle was on me, they said all those arteries would have been still pinched off. But as soon as he took the jacked up the axle and the axle was no longer in my abdomen, now I'm free bleeding out internally in those five places. That's where the incredible weakness came from. So I've got this horrible pain. Now this weakness hits. And I looked down, so I had a work uniform with the name of my company. It was called Bruce's Mobile Service, right? Real original. So this work uniform went to the edge of my ribs, went straight back, fouled along my spine, and came back up my pelvic. So I'm looking at my body now top to bottom for the first time, because as long as the axle was on me, I could only see ribs up. But as soon as he had got it up off my body, now I could see top to bottom again. My work uniform ended at my ribs, went straight back, bottle on my spine, and came back up my pelvis for this ridiculous flat spot across the middle. And there was not, it was so surreal. There was nothing in my mind to compare it to. There's absolutely no comparison. So all my brain could come up with in the moment was cartoons. And I went right to Wile E. Coyote getting run over by Acme truck, or when the rock falls on him and he's flat like a pancake. And I know that sounds silly, but that's literally what I thought when I saw myself like that. It's cartoonish. Like it's
wow.
It's scary. I mean, it's cartoonish. It's the only, there's no other way to describe it. It was cartoonish. And so I'm thinking it's like, it, but the horrible pain, right? And the fear that stupid jack's going to slip and it's going to fall on me again. So I'm begging him, get me off right the truck. He could tell I had to have a broken back. He could see the flat spot. He's terrified. He's not going to touch me. So I'm obviously in shock. I'm panicking like crazy. And I'm begging him. He said, no, I called 911. They're coming. And so I'm on that creeper, and that plastic creeper is flat in the middle. You know, again, thank God, because there's no metal, there's no wheels, there's no nothing. It's just a plastic hollow core, you know, flat thing, and it, air in the middle. And so then it got collapsed to nothing, but the wheels are still on the end and they're still fine. So I grabbed the bottom of the bumper back here behind my head, and it took everything I had, but I dragged myself out this far. I got myself this far. Again, I'm in shock, right? And then now the bumper is like right here. And I look underneath and the axle's above my legs. And I'm like, man, it's going to fall and hit me on the legs if it falls. Because I was sure it was going to fall again. Because where he had it, I was just positive it was going to fall again. So I put my palms on the bumper. And I knew if I could straighten out just do a straighten out to push one more to get a little bit further out, that I'd clear my legs. And if it fell, it wouldn't get me. But when I got right here, that was the exact moment when I tried to do that second push. Because you can imagine that the chaos, the pain, all the craziness, the moment. When I went to do that second push, I couldn't do it. My body was, I was so weak and my body was shaking. And I, for whatever reason, I fixated on this right bicep and it was shaking so fast. My whole arm was shaking like a blur. Like I, it's the only way I can describe it. It was like shaking. So it was like a blur. And I thought, this is it. I am dying. I'm dying. It's all I can think of. You're dying. And that's when I realized I couldn't breathe. My lungs had been collapsed. Both lungs were collapsed in the bottom. And it was when my arm was shaking that I realized this is what I'm doing. And I just couldn't get it in. I couldn't get that next breath. And it was so scary. Like it was such a terrifying feeling not being able to suck that next breath in. And my heart, because I'm in shock. So my pulse is crazy elevated and my heart's just pounding. And sometimes, when you're running around, you can hear your pulse in your ear. Like, you know how you can sometimes hear your own pulse?
Yeah.
You hear it pop, pop, pop. I could hear it pounding away. And it was the weirdest thing. It was just like shutting off the engine. I heard my engine, my heart stop. It was like beat, beat, bop, 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 bop. And like the last beat of my heart, my spirit left my body, went up the roof of the garage. Typical near death or out of body experiences. I've done some research. They right now in the world, if you follow the averages, you go with the world population, you do the math. Just doing the math, there is, based on the percentage, there are a couple million, several million people right now who have, based on the percentages, several million people who've had out of body or near death experience like me. And so when my heart stopped, my spirit left my body. I'm Christian. I believe what the Bible says, that we're made in the image of God. We're a three part being, body, soul, spirit. I believe my spirit is what left my body. Went up to the roof of the garage, maybe 14, 15, 16 feet. I'm watching down from above, and I can just say this. I had struggled with suicide early in my life and battled depression and stuff over my childhood. And I, always wanted peace. Mm-hmm. When I was in the ceiling was the peace I have always, always wanted. I've got no other words to describe it, but the Bible says peace that surpasses mental understanding, more peace than we can even comprehend. That's what I experienced in the sea. I don't have words. I say all the time, because I don't have words for it, the best I could say is I used to party a lot. So I say I was having a party in the ceiling by myself. I was literally having a party in the ceiling all by myself and just in this amazing peace, looking down. I could hear everybody, the volunteer workers, the emergency volunteer fire department. The first two guys actually got there before, when I was trying to get myself that last thing, those guys showed up right then. And they were trying to manipulate my arms, I guess, to manipulate the diaphragm to help me to breathe. And that's when I quit breathing. My spirit, they were right there for when I stopped breathing. So my spirit left. I'm up there watching from above. So there's already two guys there, but it's a volunteer fire department. You know, they came when their pagers went off from wherever they were coming from. Those two guys, I asked later, a year later, when I spent the next year in the hospital. But when I did get out of the hospital, and I went and spoke at that volunteer fire department to say thank you, like over a little over a year later. I asked them, how did you guys get there so soon? Because I doing the math, it was minutes within there. They were driving home from work. Their pagers go off. This is back in the day, pagers. Their pagers went off and they're like, boom, right there. Boom, boom, the first two guys. So anyway, I'm up above. I'm watching from above. And when I quit breathing, they stood back because they see the massive injury and they're not going to do CPR. So they just basically stood back. And they, at this point, you know, they've called MedFlight and they stand back. And Leonard, I'm watching from above. Leonard, because I've known him forever. I mean, we're family friends. Our families were, and he gets down, he's on his knees and he's crying, he's running his fingers through my hair. And again, I'm watching all from above and I hear every word he's saying. He's saying stuff like, I should be the one that's dead, not you. I'm such an old fool. I'm sorry because he jacked up the truck, not used the safety equipment, knew better. It was a shortcut. I'd done the same shortcut. That's why I went underneath it in the first place. I wasn't really too worried about it. You know, so it was my own fault. It's not even completely his fault. So anyway, he's crying over it. I'm up in the ceiling, but I could care less. And the weirdest thing was, and other people have had out-of-body experiences. Some people said this too. I didn't even know that that was me underneath the truck. It was like I was just completely disassociated from the whole thing. I'm looking down in an accident scene. I can hear every word Leonard's saying. And he's running his fingers through that guy's hair down there, and he's crying over him. And it was, you know, when you watch a movie sometimes, the old movie trick where they've got the camera dialed in really close, zoomed in on something. But then I remember this in old Westerns, but then they pan it out. And it's like pans out for like a million miles away. And then you see other stuff that you couldn't see originally. That's just like what I experienced in the sitting. I was panned in. I was like zoomed in on Leonard over me crying and stuff. But it was like then the camera panned out. Kind of is the only way I can describe it. And on each side of him and me was an angel. And so Leonard on his knees, 6'1", 6'2". And the angels on their knees on each side of him. And the one from the driver's side reaches over and puts his hands in the middle flat spot. And the one for the passenger side did the same thing, but their heads were approximately, I'm guesstimating, like 2 feet taller than Leonard on their knees. So that means they had to be approximately 8 feet tall if they'd been standing up. They had really long.
How did you know they were angels?
I knew. All I can say is I knew instantly. In fact, I said to myself, look, those angels are down there to help that guy. They didn't have wings. They were just 8 feet tall men. Very muscular, big, broad shoulders, narrow waist, and they had a belt right on their robes. And they're in. So I looked it up in the Bible, and the angels have mentioned 290 sometimes, and a handful of times it mentions their bright, shining robes. And that's exactly what I saw, bright, shining robes. And they had a belt, and they had really long hair that went all the way down where their belt was. And I never got to see their faces. They never talked. In fact, other than seeing them reach over and touch, that's the only movement I ever saw them do, was from going like this to reaching over and touching the middle of my belly. That was the only movement I saw. Other than that, they were still statues then. They never moved again. But I could, from the back, I could tell they're men. They're, you know, big men. So I'm just watching. I'm like, oh, those angels are down there to help that guy. And the weird thing was, it didn't even seem like a big deal. It just seemed normal, oddly, up there. So I'm just watching it all happen. And everybody's just kind of, more people keep coming. 10 people from the volunteer fire department show up. I count from above. 10 people. Number 9 and 10 came in the wrong door. Everybody else came in the front door. There's a blacktop driveway where I backed in my truck all 3 days. And everybody came just like that. But number 9 and 10 came in the back door. They came up the driver's side of the truck. It was a red-haired lady, the only woman, and a gray-haired guy, the only gray-haired guy. They came in together in the back door. A year later, when I spoke at the volunteer fire department, there was like, you know, 30-ish people there. It's over a year later. And I went around the room. The only one that knew I was going to be there was a chief, and he held me in a little side room. They start the meeting, and he's like, hey, come out here. So I went out, and I just said, wanted to tell people thank you. Well, 30-ish people in the room. And I went around, I picked out 8 of the 10 that had been to the accident scene a year, like a little over a year before. I said, you were there, you were there, you were there. And it was easy because the red-haired lady and the gray-haired guy, the only gray-haired guy and the only red, the only woman. And I said, do you and you? And I, in front of everybody, asked them, you came in the back door. Everybody else came in the front door. You came in the back door. Why? I'd never even gone out that door. I worked there for 3 days on that site. I never even gone out that door. And they said, well, we missed the driveway where, you know, their pager gave an address, whatever. They drive and they say, oh, there's the flashing lights, but they had gone past it. And it's right on a corner too. So it's, I don't know how they missed it, but they went past it and they said, oh, we caught a secondary gravel driveway that was further down the road that went angled up towards the back of the shop. So it was a secondary, a back entrance to the shop, and they just came in. So that was a that was the detail of why they came in the back door. But here's the deal. At that point, I had already been no heartbeat, no pulse for minutes. So wow. I was able to tell them they came in the wrong door. And I asked them why, and they couldn't even remember why at first. They're like, what? They looked at each other like, wrong door? What is he talking about? I said, you came in the back door. Everybody came in. It took them a minute to even remember because it's been a year. And they're like, oh, yeah. We drove by. And then we, you know, I was like, then we saw the flashing lights. Then we came from the people there before them. So then we came up the next, we saw that gravel driver went up there and it was right there. So it wasn't a big deal, but it was a big deal because of the detail of me seeing where, because even where my body was at, my carcass at this point, with no heartbeat, no pulse, shouldn't have been to tell anybody what door they came in. So I'm watching from above. She gets down between the angels and she's feeling for a pulse. She moves Leonard out of the way. And because it's the last two people to get there, everybody else already knows, no heartbeat, no pulse. And as for me looking down in the passenger's corner of this truck, there was a big guy in what I call farmer bibs. There's those gray bibs with the blue stripes. And it was a big guy and he had his arms crossed. There was this little guy next to him. And the big guy with his arms crossed said to her, it's two ladies already passed. And the lady ignored him. Her name's Shannon. I didn't know at the time, never met her before. And so she's feeling for a pulse. And he said it again. He's two ladies passed. And she says to Leonard, what's his name? Leonard goes, Bruce Finetta. And this lady, I'm watching off from above. This lady starts doing this, slapping me in the face and saying, yelling, Bruce Finetta, come back. So there's 8, 9 other people in the room. They're all respectfully, quietly talking. They all stopped. And they all lean in and look at her like, crazy lady, what are you doing? Right? And she's doing this. Bruce Finetta, come back. And everybody just quits talking. They're just looking at her. And the weirdest thing was, the only way I can describe this is it somehow sounded vaguely familiar. And my spirit started creeping down from the ceiling. And it felt like when I got about halfway, it went really fast. And it seemed like my spirit came in through the top of my head, is the only way I could describe the sensation. Came in through the top. My heart miraculously starts. Now, this is depending on which person in the room you believe. Everybody's got a different story, right? 6 to 8 to 10 minutes, no heartbeat, no pulse. My heart starts, no CPR, no medicine, no blood transfusions, not a pick, not a poke, nothing. Me laying in the truck, 6 to 8 to 10 minutes, no heartbeat. This woman, Shannon, shows up, 38 years old at the time. I find out later she was a 2-month-old baby Christian. She was reading Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John. Somebody told her just read the gospel. So she's a stay-at-home mom reading Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John for 2 months with her kids. When she showed up the scene of the accident, in that 2 months, at some point at the beginning of that 2 months, that's why she received, you know, whatever. She made a prayer to say, Jesus, come in my heart. Somebody says, okay, now read the Bible. And she's like, where? And they said, read the gospels, Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John. So she said for the previous 2 months, she's just reading the gospels. She never goes to church, right? She just at her home reading this old Bible on her kitchen table. So she shows up and this Christian lady, when she's slapping, we asked her, I talked to her a year later. We had her family over and their kids and we had a cookout and stuff. And then we're asking like, why were you slapping me? Like, where did that come from? And she said, I just read a verse in the Bible where Jesus said, those who believe in me will do the same things I'm doing. In fact, greater things will you do. And she's like, well, Jesus prayed people back to life. And apparently she had seen a relative when somebody was drowning and they pulled them off the bottom of the pond or pool or whatever the water was. And she watched as a kid, her grandma freaked out and started slapping the kid and the water comes gushing up because grandma's freaking out, right? And she reverted back to this childhood memory and started praying and saying, commanding me, praying for me to come back to life and started slapping me. So my spirit comes back into my body and I go back at from feeling the best I've ever felt in my entire life to now being in a body that's crushed in half and it feels the worst I've ever felt. And the first thing was, oh, 4-letter word that means fertilizer. I'm the guy in the truck and it all came back to me. Oh no. Oh no, I'm the guy. And I remember the truck fell on me and it's like, oh no, I've been watching from above those agents. I'm the guy in the truck. And I was just like, I said, no, it hurts too bad. I don't want this. And I remember saying that like, no, I don't want this. I want that. This hurts too bad. And my heart stopped. My spirit left my body. I went right back up the roof of the garage. I'm back in perfect peace. I'm looking down. I see the angels. I see the lady above me. I see her just, you know, doing, getting all frantic. But this time, like people talk about sometimes when they have these out-of-body experiences, a tunnel. And that's what I saw, a tunnel going up out of the roof of the garage, like at approximately 45-degree angle, a million miles long with a bright light on the end of it. And just like I knew that those were angels, somehow instinctively, I knew that I knew that I knew that I knew. Heaven was on the end of that tunnel and Jesus was there waiting for me and I was excited. And I got in the tunnel and it was so cool because I like fast cars, fast motorcycles. I like to feel that G-force acceleration. And I got in the tunnel. I could feel that acceleration. It felt good. I'm rocketing away towards the light, happy, excited. I was getting pumped, getting ready to go meet Jesus. And I could hear it back there. Bruce Fanata, come back. I stopped in the tunnel. I got sucked backwards and I knew where I wanted to go. So that's where I was looking. And I got sucked backwards and I'm back in the roof of the garage, still looking at the tunnel, looking at the light. I look back down. I see the lady. I see what she's doing. I see the angels. My spirit comes back into my body. My heart starts again, miraculously. Again, no medical intervention. It's this lady slapped me in the face and praying. My spirit comes back in. My heart starts. And I looked on my left and I looked on my right for the angels. And I couldn't see them. And it terrified me because, like, where'd they go? Like, I really need them. This hurts really bad. Like, this is bad. This is really bad. Where'd they go? And they were gone. I couldn't see them. And, you know, people now they're freaking out because this crazy stuff's happening. And now people are kind of running around. So it was very chaotic and this horrible pain. I remember shutting my eyes again and just, I was like, oh man. And that's when all I say is a still small whisper, a still small quiet voice in my head that I know, that I know, that I know is God. And it simply said, he wasn't, everybody else was panicking, freaking out. This voice was very calm and just said this, if you want to live, you're going to have to fight and it's going to be a hard fight. See, God knew I was going to spend the next year in the hospital. He knew that I'd have to learn to walk again, learn to read again, learn to write again. All the rehab after I get out of the hospital, in the hospital, all stuff. Days I'd be begging him to let me die in the hospital, locking myself in the bathroom and just lay on the floor and say, God, please let me die. I can't do this. He knew all that. He's like, if you want to live, you're going to have to fight. And it's going to be a hard fight. And so I was like, screw it. I don't want to fight. It hurts too bad. And I left. And I went up back in the roof of the garage, back to perfect peace. And the tunnel opened up. And I'm like, that's what I'm talking about. And I got in the tunnel and I started going towards the light. And it felt amazing. But Miss 2-month-old baby Christian wasn't having it on her watch.
She wouldn't give up.
She wasn't yet. Yeah, she wasn't lukewarm yet, man. She was still on fire and zealous for God. She didn't have any time to get lukewarm yet. So she prays me back. My spirit comes back out of the ceiling. I'm looking from above. I see the angels again. And acting like they are there. And my spirit comes back in my body the third and final time. She said, she's interviewed. I've been on like a bunch of TV shows and Discovery Channel, Country Music Television, History Channel, a bunch secular ones as well as, you know, Christian ones. And I think it was when she was on Discovery Channel when they interviewed her that she said that the first two times my eyes, every time my heart would start, my eyes would pop open. And then when it would stop, my eyes would close. But she said the last time that my heart had stopped, my eyes didn't close all the way. They only went like halfway. My eyelids were like halfway closed. And then when it came back in that last time, they opened up. So her face is right here. And she says to me, my spirit came in that last time and heart started. She says to me, Mister, you're on the verge of life and death. And thinking, lady, you have no idea what I'm experiencing on my end over here. And she's right there. And then she says, what do you have to fight for? Do you have a wife? Do you have kids? And I knew right there. This is not an afterthought. Right in that exact moment, despite all the pain, I recognized and I knew that it was the same whisper that had whispered to me, if you want to live, you have to fight. It's going to be a hard fight. God, I knew, was speaking through her. Even though it was her voice, I just know it was God. And I knew it. I felt it. And God reminded me, I asked him, do you have a wife? Do you have kids? See, because it was up to me. That's what I wanted my whole life. That's what I wanted my whole entire life. And it was like, I was out of here. There's no way I would stay. No way. But then God reminded me through this woman about my wife. And I had four little kids. We had twins in the middle. So we actually had four kids in 3 years. And they were all little at the time. And I thought, I'd seen some rough stuff with non-biological kids not getting treated the same as biological kids and broken families and stuff. And, I, for them, I'd stay for my family even as bad as it hurt. And that's what it was. Well, I couldn't stay for me. I couldn't. But for them, for my wife and my kids, I could. So she said, don't close your eyes. And I was thinking, lady, yeah, because every time I close my eyes, I'm going up there. And if I need to be here for my wife and kids, I can't close my eyes. So volunteer fire department forgot to call the ambulance. They called the med flight. The helicopter comes. No way to get me out to the helicopter. The helicopter goes back to Madison, RBS Trauma Center. Then they call the ambulance, picks me up from Adams Friendship. That's the next town over, closest 20, 30 minutes away from the accident scene, 20 minutes away at least from the accident scene. That little hospital, ambulance comes, picks me up, takes me back to that little hospital. And I'm only there for the helicopter to come back the second time from Madison, pick me up there and take me to the Madison Trauma Center where they operated on me, emergency operation. My wife and my mom and some people from our church, she brought people from church. I used to joke. I'd say I married an atheist bartender and she turned into a church lady from Saturday Night Live. She wanted to start going to church. She wanted to tease her all the time. I'm like, oh, you're church lady. And she wanted to do this. And we started going to church. You know, we got married and I came out of complete drug and alcohol life. And, she wanted to start going to church and we went to church and, you know, she quit her job where she was working at the bank and went to work at the church. And then I was really teasing her. Oh yeah. Church lady. Right. So church lady shows up with church people after the night of the accident. And, I got to be, completely transparent for the year going up to that accident, that whole year going up to that accident, God had been working on me like crazy. It got me completely sober. We were attending Bible studies and I was actively involved in church too. It wasn't just her. And that was the year going up right before the accident, that whole year. And then the accident happened. And, so she shows up at the doctors do what they can do. There was a doctor actually from out of country, a trauma doctor that happened to be there that night from out of country. And those two doctors worked on me, Dr. Flamito Ito and another doctor, the local doctor, they worked on me. And then they called in the head of the trauma center, who is, they say, a genius. He's the guy who runs the whole trauma center, used to. And they called him from home and he finished up. And after he finished up, he came out and told my wife that he said that he'd never seen, all the years he had been the head of the trauma. He said, and this is our state's biggest trauma center. He said, all the years of being the head of that trauma center, he said he'd never seen a body so badly traumatized and make it to the hospital alive. He said, your husband must have, well, one hell of a will to fight, is what he told my wife. He said, but I don't expect him to live through the hour. He goes, he's so badly damaged. He said, all we could do is hook up some of the places of the arteries, pinch off the other places. They put in over 2.5 times what the body holds for, or like about, I'll just say approximately two times what the body holds for blood they put into me. So my blood was just leaking out because, before they did the emergency operation to do what they did. So they're trying to put blood in me, which is internally leaking out. And what happened was I zeroed out. They were actually taking a round of CAT scans, about to take a second round of CAT scans when I zeroed out. And that's when they rushed me. I mean, I remember distinctly because I did keep my eyes open all the way through the whole process to where they were doing the CAT scans to when my blood pressures went to zero and they pulled me out. Even though they were trying to put blood in me, I went to zero anyway. And that's when they did the emergency surgery. And I remember the mask coming down and thinking, finally, they're going to do something. They'll fix it. And so then, two, 3 hours later, he comes out, tells my wife, I don't expect her to live through the hour. Cross your fingers. And my wife, church lady, said, I'm not going to cross my fingers. We're going to pray. So one of the guys from church, she told me, Jim, said, well, the doctor said he's not going to live for an hour, so why don't every half an hour he's alive? Let's thank God for every 30 minutes of life. So I don't know where he got that or what made him think that to do that or what, but so every 30 minutes I was alive, they thank God for 30 more minutes of life all night long. The next morning, the doctor came back, and my wife said, you said there's a whole bunch of operations that need to be done. Are you going to do it or not? He said, I don't think you can handle it. They waited like 3 or 4 more hours. My wife went and harassed him again. She said, do it. You have my permission. Do it. Go. Whatever needs to be done, start doing it. Well, they put me in an induced coma. I was already in induced coma at this point. And they kept me in an induced coma for weeks, operated on me all that week, every day, a little bit, all week. They just clamped me up and then take me apart and operate on me the next day. And they just kept doing it every day. They're doing operations. And I stayed in the induced coma for several weeks. I remember when they took me down induced coma, when I came consciously to, I didn't know that I still had a breathing tube and I couldn't talk. And I was trying to talk, but I got this tube in my mouth because I'm waking up. And I didn't realize that because I was still whacked. So I didn't know I had this tube down my throat and I was trying to talk and I couldn't. And once I realized I couldn't talk because there's stuff in me, I motioned for something to write with. And all I wanted to do was write the word angel. Because even though in the ceiling, it didn't seem, it was like so nonchalant, like it wasn't a big deal. But after, you know, after I came back to it, and it was like, oh my God, I saw these two huge angels. And I mean, you know, the lady prayed back, and all, but all I wanted to do was, I just wanted to write the word angel. So I motioned for something. I was a pen or pencil. I know my mom and my wife were in the room, and they had to, you know, put something so I could write. And I couldn't make it come out. I couldn't make the A. I couldn't make it come from here to here. 6 months before I could, 6 months before I could begin to comprehend, read, write again. So it was so frustrating. I threw the writing utensil because I just wanted to tell them I couldn't. But when they did end up taking the tube out, but my lungs weren't strong enough because they've been collapsed, which is really terrifying. So they wake me up, take me out of seduced coma, pull the thing out and see if I'm going to breathe. I couldn't breathe. So I'm doing the same thing I was doing when I, you know, at the scene of the accident. So they had to reintubate. It was a horrible year. I'll just stand up. I'll show you the scars. You can see 5 times they went through this hole. And that doesn't account all the times they did it, like the first, you know, week or whatever. But, you know, I don't know how the camera will show it, but. Wow. 5 times from here to here, basically. They went through here. It's a big L-shaped net in here. Otherwise, this would be all hernias. I got one hernia left because it's an open spot that's not netted so that they can do access, because a net grows into your muscle and then they can't cut through it. And that way, if they have to do any more surgeries, this is where they'll come through for, you know, my access point. So I don't have a belly button anymore. I've got this nice little hernia. And this is just some muscle ripped up. But J-tubes, G-tubes, drainage tubes, you know, it was, like I said, it was a horrible year. They let me out for a couple weeks. I'd go back in for a couple months. I'd get out for a couple days. I'd go back in for a month, in and out, in and out. We added up the days. I spent more than a year in the hospital in my life. I hate the way hospitals smell. I hate everything about them. It's, I couldn't eat. The truck fell on me. It destroyed my small intestines. Your small intestines are, it's right underneath your belly button. Your small intestines are like a big ball of worms. Literally, it's all like, you know, big ball of worms. Right underneath your belly button. So when the truck found me, it destroyed my small intestines. They've told me that adults have 18 to 20 some, depending on how you're made by God, 18 to 20 some feet length of small intestine. So all of my small intestine was destroyed except for 2 pieces. And the doctor sewed up, salvaged out 2 pieces that were damaged, but not completely destroyed, he thought. So he salvaged what he could, because you can't live without a small intestine. You can't. They can't keep you alive on. In 2006, they were not keeping you alive for more than a year on parental nutrition. So they remove all my intestines except these 2 pieces, you know, a couple feet, little over 2.5 feet of intestine left. So then I'm being fed intravenously. I don't eat nothing for months. Nothing can go in here for like months. It was horrible. They wouldn't even let me drink water, nothing. It was all through the veins. And so it was a horrible time. I lose 65 pounds. I'm starving to death. I'm type A. I can't hold still. I wasn't a good patient because I'm wound up tighter than, you know, Johnny Cash's guitar string. So I'm like bouncing off the wall. I want out of this place. I got 8 IVs, 4 in each arm. I had 10 medicines. So they had to alternate. I mean, it was just this horrible thing. I didn't trust them. I was fighting with the doctors to let me out of here, right? So they said, okay, if we let you go home and have a nurse care for you at home in before your next operation where your attitude get better. I'm like, yeah, send me home. So I got to go home a couple times just to get out of the hospital. But so I get in a fight with this doctor this one day, and I said, you got to let me out of here. I said, I'm embarrassed I said this, but I said, this is not a communist country. You can't make me stay here. And she said, Mr. Vanetta, we're not going to keep you here forever. I said, you can't keep me here forever. And she said, Mr. Vanetta, we're not going to keep you here forever. This is the first time I'd heard it. She said, we can only keep you alive for another 6 months to a year at the very most. You're starving to death. You're dying. I'd lost 65 pounds at that point. If you saw me 65 pounds less than I am, I looked like somebody straight out of concentration camp. My skull was totally, you can see it perfectly, every bone in my body. And so anyway, I'm dying because I'm starving to death. And let's see, it happened in November. In March.
And then what happened with the small intestine?
Yeah, the accident happened November. In March, I'm 65 pounds down, and God wakes up a man in New York 2 mornings in a row, and God told him, buy a plane ticket, fly to Wisconsin, pray for a guy in the hospital. The first morning, he blew it off, told his wife, and he told his pastor. And he was a church worker. He's not a pastor, but he was a church worker. Told his wife and told his pastor, said, this is really weird. Never had anything like this, but I don't think it must have been not just me. Because I was on prayer chain out at that church. They were praying for me after the accident. They knew I was hurt. So he heard about my story from Sunday morning. Let's pray for this guy. So the next morning it happens again. He felt it had to be God. So he bought a plane ticket, cost him 900 some bucks. in 2006. Instantaneous ticket from New York to Wisconsin. People from my church picked him up. They brought him to the hospital. This guy prayed for me in the hospital. And the church we came from was not spirit-filled, charismatic. It was like old school Oregon guy in the front with a white collar type church. And so, you know, I was comfortable with, like, honestly, if somebody said at your church, hey, I'll pray for you, you probably didn't mean it. Like, it was something nice to say. And if you did say it, he was like, you're definitely not going to stop right there and ever, like, pray for them there. You just say, hey, I'll pray for you. You know what I mean? Like church lingo, right?
Yeah.
And that's where I went to church. So this guy shows up at the hospital just to pray, literally. Started praying for me normal. And so in my church, if you pray and you close your eyes and bow your head, you know, and just be, this guy touches. And in my church, hey, keep your hands to yourself if you're praying. But this guy reaches over, he puts his, like the Bible talks about laying on of hands, and he puts a palm on my forehead. And I was used to like praying to God type praying. But there's another type of praying in the Bible that Jesus talks about in Mark 11, where he said, speak to the mountain in my name. Talk to the problem in my name, you know. And so that's what this guy does. And he started commanding my, he said, small, you know, he just said, small intestine, I command you to grow back right now in the name of Jesus, which to me was, you know, sounded crazy, but he said it and it felt like I got shocked, like electricity, like touching electric fence, came out of his palm, was already touching me. I swear I didn't hear a snap. I don't know if you've ever touched electric fence, but you'll hear the shock. You'll get shocked, but you hear it too. Snap. Zzz. And I heard it, and it went right into my intestine. I could feel my intestine coming back. And I turned to the Brian, the guy that brought him. I said, dude, it just felt like a snake came and coiled inside me. He's the only way I could verbalize what I felt. All of a sudden, my weight levels out. I start gaining weight. The doctors think that I've got some kind of parental nutrition malfunction, and I'm gaining water weight. So they got to adjust the formula, they called it. They had to adjust the formula because I'm gaining water weight. They adjust the formula. I'm gaining more weight. I start sneaking, you know, some stuff. I'm drinking a little bit. And they're like, oh, we got to have you. We got to do emergency. We got to do this. You got to drink this barium and we got to do a test and see what's going on. There's something, you know. And that's when they found out that I have, they say, half my small intestine now. And what's cool is, you know, all the doubting skeptics always say, show me your medical records. Show me medical records. Well, it's cool because I have, used to send them out all the time. The problem is, it's over 1,000 pages. It's not like there's ever one page that says, atheist doctor that I had. It's not like there's ever one page where he said, miracle happened to this guy ever. Basically, people have to go through those 1,000 pages, somebody medical that knows medical stuff, like doctor, research it, figure it out. And I had somebody do it, and they took out like over, it's over 1,000 pages, and they put together like a 40-page sizzle reel of like these, if somebody knows Dr. Lingo, these 40 pages will make you know you could go A to B to C and know all the miracles that happened with this guy. So basically, it's two huge miracles. I'm the only person, doctors say this, I don't, there's been studies done on it. They say I'm the only person to live with having major arteries severed in five places. There's nobody else in the world that's had major arteries severed in five different places that live. So there's that. And then they say I have half my intestines. So if you have, you know, like I said, you know, 18 to 20 some feet, that they're saying that I have 9 to 11 feet. Different people, different opinions. You know, I've had people say at least 11, 12, 13 feet, whatever. Whoever, you know, because it's subjective, but it's still ballparkish.
Yeah.
And here's the cool thing. When they looked at my records, I never caught this, but somebody that wanted to like really go through the records, they found that the best proof, even though the doctor notated the two pieces, how long they were when he put them back in me, which is nowhere near half my intestines, it's like, you know, 100 centimeters. And then in March, one of those pieces died. I forgot to tell you that. One of the two pieces that he saved in my intestine died. He had emergency surgery take it out because it was too damaged. So then I was less, way under 100 centimeters. Then the guy comes. That's when they said I was going to die. Then the guy comes and prays for me. The creative miracle happens. I get half my intestines back. So when they look at it, I mean, I would have died. I would have died. I would have starved to death, you know, 16 years ago already. Like the doctor said, if that miracle wouldn't happen. So there's two huge miracles. Five arteries severed, and over, here's the crazy thing for medical people listening. Five places, major arteries severed, with, you can't put a tourniquet or put any, you know, can't stop the bleeding. There's no way to stop it internally when it's in your abdomen. And five places, and from the point the truck fell on me until they started operating on me, over 2.5 hours. They say if you have one major artery severed, you don't put a tourniquet on it, 8 to 10 minutes is the max, and you're going to bleed out. I had five places. Over 2.5 hours. So right there, that's such a huge miracle. You know, that in itself, even without the intestine thing. And then when they do the math, you know, somebody found the coolest thing about it is when they sent the, what he removed, what he sent to the pathology, the math works both ways. So it's not just saying, okay, it's just going to ride on this doctor's opinion. These two doctors that wrote the report that he's got 100 centimeters. And now we know he's got, you know, you know, 600 centimeters or whatever it is. I don't know metric, whatever half, whatever 9-11 feet is in centimeters. That's what they say I have, right? But I had less than 100. And so there's that huge miracle. There's no way to explain it. And when you do the pathology, they said what he sent to pathology, it all adds up. So in other words, I have a creative miracle happen. Half my intestines came out of nowhere.
And what was the
based
doctor's,
on what they said, the pathology makes it all add up.
What was the doctor's reaction to the small intestine growing back?
So it was four times the scar, right? The big scar I showed you. Five times he went through that hole. So between number four and number five is when the guy came and prayed for me. So I obviously was unconscious under sedation, but I was told when the doctor opened me for my last major operation, which was in December of 2007, a year and a month after the truck fell on me, he opened me up because the one rib never did stick. So he ended up taking it out and throwing it away. My gallbladder got wrecked because of parental nutrition. The parental nutrition wrecked my gallbladder in that period, that 6 months or whatever I was on the parental nutrition. So it destroyed my gallbladder because you're not designed to be fed off your thing. So fed off a vein. So they had to remove my gallbladder, take out a rib, take out some scar tissue and some of there was five little cleanup things. That's the last operation. So the atheist doctor cut me open and one of the other doctors that was in the room and one of the nurses said, when he cut me open, you know, cause you saw how big the scars and he saw with his own eyes. Now at that point, he'd been me four times. The last time he was in, he took out a piece of intestine he knew was bad and he knew I didn't have enough intestine left to live now. And now he opens me up and they said, when he saw that I had half my intestines, they said he threw the scalpel and began to scream and swear and just had a meltdown. Turned away from the body, turned away from me. They said he faced the wall and was screaming and swearing. And just then he melted, you know, after he melted down, he calmed himself down, then turned back around, asked for another scalpel, fresh scalpel, went back to work. I make a corny dad joke. And I say at that point, he obviously hated my guts. But think about it.
So why do you think he was screaming and swearing when he saw I mean, was he just in shock?
Atheist, genius. He's an atheist, doesn't believe in God, but he is a medical genius. They proved a bunch of stuff. When the president used to come to this state, he was the guy that put on call. They do that every place. The president goes somewhere, they get a trauma doctor ready for him, just in case anything happens. I found that out when I was there. And this is the guy they put on call. So he's the best of the best kind of guy, right? So he couldn't make sense. He knew he had removed all that intestine. And there it was staring in the face. And he couldn't make sense of it. So he got angry. So we found out later when History Channel interviewed him for a show called Miracles Decoded. Didn't play in the American market, but it played in Canadian market, 60 other markets. And when they did that show, they went and interviewed him. He's no longer in this season, another state. So they went out there and interviewed him. So it was an atheist interviewer. And I told him that he was atheist. So the atheist interviewer thinks she thinks, hey, I'm going to say I'm an atheist and, you know, we're going to bond over it on off the camera. She told me this later because they interviewed him first. She said, when she says to him, yeah, I'm an atheist, I heard you are too. He said, I'm not an atheist. And she said, well, Bruce Vanessa said you're an atheist. And he said, I used to be an atheist. He said, but he told her that was the first case that I knew there was some other power at work that I could not explain. And since that time, because this was 8 years or 10 years after the accident, he said, since that time, there's been other times where I've seen that I know there's some other power that's at work. That I don't understand, that's out of this world. And she said, oh, so now you're a Christian? He goes, no, I didn't say that. He said, I'm an agnostic. He goes, I know there's a higher power. I'm just not sure who it is yet. That's already been years ago now, so I don't know where the guy's at. I haven't talked to him for several years, but I think God's definitely talking his language, telling him, showing him. Yeah.
Wow. And your wife was telling you before the accident, right, that you were called to ministry or something, and that
I started that job on Tuesday the 14th. The truck fell on me on Thursday the 16th. When I took the truck apart that day, Tuesday the 14th, I came home. We're in our bedroom. Right out there is the kitchen. I came home that night. The kids were in bed. She had saved me a plate of supper. I was used to working 12s. A lot of times I came home, everybody's in bed. Lori heated it up in the microwave. We sat down at the table out there. And after working 12 hours, I was just tired, wanted to go to sleep, eat and go take a shower and go to bed. And she's stuck with four kids all day. She wants to have adult talk. And I just want to sleep. You know what I mean? I'm just, so I'm sitting there eating. And she started in on this conversation with herself kind of. And she's like, as I said, in that year going up to the accident, we've been doing Bible studies and we were actually leading them at our house. I was doing it at our house because they asked for volunteers and the pastor asked if we'd do it. So I did it. So she says, you know what? I know it. Everybody knows us, says we're called to full-time ministry. And she says, I think we're in disobedience and we should just go on a full-time ministry. She said, in fact, don't go back to work tomorrow. She said, let today be the last day. She said, let's just quit. And I remember pulling up my pocket planner, and I had like 3 months worth of work lined up. And I'm like, yeah, and just walk away from like 50 grand. I'm like, are you kidding me? I love my job. I was really good at it. I was treated like the hero because I'd show up and fix stuff that a lot of people couldn't fix. I mean, I got paid really good to do it. I love being outside. I mean, I really love my job. And God was calling me to ministry, but I didn't want to go. So I slammed my fist on the table and told her, shut up, leave me alone. And she stood up at that point and said to me three times, Bruce Vanetta, what is it going to take before you're obedient to God? And then 2 days later, the truck fell on me. And I spent a year in hospital, and then I spent 2 years in rehab. But we started the ministry January 1st, 2008. And I mean, I a lot of times will stand up and show people these scars and say, really, the scars of disobedience. And God didn't want the accident to happen. He tried to prevent it. He sent my wife. She begged me. She said, don't go back to work tomorrow. I'm the one that slammed my fist on the table and said, shut up, leave me alone. You know, so.
And so how are you physically now? I mean, are you completely, you know, well?
Let's say if a bear was chasing you and me, I'd be the one that gets eaten. I can't run. I look awkward if I try to run. I can walk fine. People would never know to see me walk around. But if I try to run all out, then it looks awkward. There's something not things don't work quite right. But I can ride my Harley. I can drag a deer out of the woods. I can ride a four-wheeler. I can, you know, play pickleball with my kids. I can do whatever I want to do. I still have digestive issues. Bottom line, not to be gross, but I battle diarrhea. It's been since the accident. It's just been, you know, eating issues because of my everything getting crushed. Pancreas was crushed. I mean, everything was squished. So I battled that.
And what did your kids think about all this? What I mean, when they got older and understood what happened to you, what did they think?
I can tell you this. Two of my kids are in full-time ministry.
Praise God.
Yeah, so that's something. And the other two might not be in full-time ministry, but they believe in God, and they know when the crap hits the fan, where you go.
Wow. And was your wife, when she came, when she first found out that you'd been crushed by the truck, was she traumatized? Like, was she freaked out or was she calm?
So it's weird because the people, because I knew Leonard since I was a little kid, he called his wife, who then called my mom, and my mom then called Lori to say that the accident happened. So that's how the phone call went in a circle to come back to Lori to say the accident happened. And my mom got her on the phone and she said, where are you? And she said, I'm at home waiting for Bruce to get home from, he should have been home from work already. And my mom said, honey, sit down wherever you're at, sit down. And so Lori's like, okay. And just my wife told me later, she thought for sure my mom was going to say that one of my two brothers were dead because we're also crazy and the crazy life we live. And so she said, Bruce has had a really bad accident and he's been med flighted and they don't know if he's going to make it. That's it. They don't know if he's going to make it. And so my wife, church lady, this is so crazy. I don't like talking about this because it makes me cry, but my wife told me she got, I don't know, can you see? You can see right there. She kneeled down in front of that window right there. And right there is where we do our devotions. And you can see the old Bible. It doesn't even have a cover because it's so ripped up and used up right there. She said she got down on her knees in front of that window and prayed to God. And she said, God, if he can't be the man he wants to be, if he's going to be permanently disabled or hurt to where he's not going to be happy with life, then you can take him. That is such an unselfish prayer. I can't even imagine ever praying that prayer.
Wow.
But if you can make him okay, God, please heal him. Please let him be okay. And all she took was her Bible, and that woman never left my side for 3 weeks. She stayed in the intensive care. She never left my side for 3 weeks, and all she took was her Bible. So I used to always tease her about being the church lady, and man, she really proved it.
Wow.
The old Dana Carvey, right? Must be Satan, that one.
Wow. And so now, of course, now you're in full-time ministry.
Yeah.
So tell people how 16, they 17 can. Years.
Sweetbread Ministries. That's the name of our ministry, sweetbreadministries.com or .org. Either one will get you to our website. I go around, I share this testimony. And basically I just tell people God loves us despite us. I know God told me right away when somebody asked me on international television the first time, if he read in the bio, I mean, we send the bio out and he read in the bio that Dr. Sam Lillens lived after having majority severed in 5 places. And he said, well, why did God save you? I wasn't prepared for the question at all, but God immediately gave me an answer. And he said, turn to 1 Corinthians 1:26. I flipped to it and I'll just paraphrase, and it says God chooses things that are not a noble birth, things that are lowly, despised, weak things. he goes to this list of demeaning adjectives and says, God chooses these things so that no one may boast before him. And so when I tell my story, testimony, whatever you want to call it, Beckett, to you, your audience, or anybody, or if I'm in a jail or at a church or school, I can't stand there and tell them God saved me because I'm a good guy. In fact, just the opposite. Really, he told me that he saved me to show that he set the bar so low that if he'd save someone with the life I lived, that he'd save anybody.
Wow.
For real. So, and I do believe that's true.
So now you're, you're really looking forward to going to heaven.
Oh man. My kids and my wife hate it when I say that, but it's true.
Oh, I say it all the time. I mean, I'm single and I don't have kids. So it's, you know, it's not
right.
You know, going to affect anyone really, like in my family. But yeah, I'm just like, God, take me. I want to go to heaven, please. Cause I got,
oh man, I got, it's a struggle.
Yeah.
Hey, this is serious. I've talked to other people who've had autobiotic experiences and died like me. And there's a lot of us that deal with depression, yes, and struggle because it was so good.
Well, that's what, I mean, I don't know if you know much of my story or any of it, but 14 years ago, I got saved. I live in Los Angeles and I was living like as a gay man in Los Angeles, and someone invited me to church, to an evangelical church. It's a long story, but I ended up going and I had a road to Damascus encounter with God. Like, it was so powerful. And I knew immediately that homosexuality was not my identity. I knew that it was not, I knew that it was sinful and that it was not a part of my life anymore. But that road to Damascus moment with God, it was, I mean, I was bawling like uncontrollably. And after that day, it was like I was caught up in like a glory cloud or something. And it was like, after that day, I just was like, God, just take me now.
Yeah.
I just want to go to heaven. This is amazing.
Right.
So I get it.
Because that's what it was. You were in his presence. And when you felt that presence, it's like, I don't want it to stop. I don't want this presence to leave.
I know.
That's what heaven's going to be like, in his presence.
I know. And it happened the second time the same day when I got home from that church service. I still go to the same church. But when I got home, it happened again. God was just like, and all of this, like, and I just started bawling and bawling. And so, yeah, I'm really looking forward to heaven. I can't wait.
People talk about those experiences and I laugh because I get in all kinds of churches, from like the super denominational to like the hardcore, the charismatic, the charismaniac. I mean, you name it, all different range churches I get into. I share this testimony. And it's so interesting to me, not coming from a church background, seeing how different people relate to God and the terminology. So what you just described, one place would call that, oh man, I had a throne room experience. And the other one was like, oh, I felt the Holy Spirit. I mean, but it's the same thing, right? I mean, it's the exact same thing. Just people's different nomenclature, different, you know, whatever church lingo that people use. But it's the same thing. That throne room experience, that presence, it's the presence of God. That's what it's what it's all about. He's real. And he offers that to everybody.
I know. That's what when you said he's real, like that's what happened when he revealed himself to me that day. I was like, God's real? Like, this is all real? The Bible, Jesus is real. This is true. I mean, I couldn't believe it. I was an atheist. I mean, I was an atheist by that time in my life. And I just could not believe. I was like, this is the best thing that's ever happened to me.
Beckett, if you've got just a couple minutes, can we have a couple minutes more?
Yeah.
Are we good or not?
Yeah.
So I'm just going to say this.
Oh, go ahead.
Because you shared what you just shared, I told you that I had experience with God as a young man, and that's why I knew Jesus was real and I called out, Lord, help me. So let me just tell you what happened. So I didn't go to church as a kid. We didn't go to church. I got taken to Sunday school one time as a 5-year-old by a grandpa and a grandma, my dad's mom and dad, who went to this little Lutheran church in a rural farming community. My dad is a middle child of three. My grandpa was convinced he was a product of adultery. So my dad was beaten from a toddler on, never shown any love. My mom was given away just after birth, product of illegitimate. She was an illegitimate child, raised by a grandma who wasn't married, repeatedly molested by grandma's boyfriends. So you have these two people who were never loved as children, married. That's my family. That's my mom, my dad. And so when I struggled with, you know, suicide as a kid, actually, I was going to kill myself one day as like an 18-year-old. And God literally spoke to me and said, your parents couldn't give you something they didn't have. They were never loved. They couldn't give it to you. And it was such an eye-opening experience for me. But either way, back to why I believed in Jesus and knew he's real. I went to Sunday school one time because grandpa and grandma, the grandpa that hated my dad, took me on a weekend because they babysat me. It was the only time I ever spent the night at my grandma's house once my whole life. One time I spent the night at my grandma's. That weekend, that Saturday night, we went to this church Sunday morning. 30 people in this little church, you know, maybe 3 kids in the whole Sunday school program, everybody. And I'm the stranger kid. I've never been in Sunday school in my life. We're sitting around a table and the guy's a basket with broken crayons and he's got a Xerox copy of a bearded guy hugging kids. And the Sunday school teacher told the story. Jesus, you know, he's telling us Jesus is real. And I had heard the word Jesus a million times, but I thought it was a swear word. And he said, no, Jesus is a real person. He's God. And I'd never been told about God. So he's telling me that God is real. And I was like, it was interesting to me as a 5-year-old kid, is all I could say. It was interesting to me, right? And we're pulling this picture and it's Jesus hugging his kids. And he tells a story, you know, Jesus in a place, parents are bringing their kids to hug him. Disciples get mad. They say, get these kids out of here. Jesus says, no, rebukes his disciples. Let the children come unto me. It was a really cool story. And the guy's, you know, telling us that we're coloring it. But then as Christians often do, this guy went too far. And he said this, something, I don't know what the exact words, but I know what I took out of it was he said something like, Jesus is real. And because he's real in this story, it proves that he protects kids and doesn't let anything bad happen. Right there, I stopped coloring. I put the crayon, broken crayon back in the basket. And I'm pushing that thing forward and going, ah, Jesus is a story like Santa Claus. It's made up. It's a lie. It's a made up lie. Because if Jesus was real, I'd been repeatedly molested for a year and a half. So my parents were drug and alcohol people. So that's who they hung around with, drug and alcohol people. So this husband and wife that babysat me, and they had a little boy and a little girl, a little older than me. They would watch in the mid 70s, if they're going to watch porn, it was going to be on these 9mm reels, you know, way before VHS or DVD or anything like that. So this husband and wife would get drunk, they get high, and they'd be watching these, I'm talking triple X, hardcore porn, no words, bad stuff, on the wall. And they would be doing sexual acts between themselves, but then they'd molest their kids, molest me. He thinks he's a director, do this, do that. A year and a half, it goes on. I had to stay with them all week long because my dad was an overload truck driver. My mom was an interpreter. I'm half Mexican. My mom was the only Hispanic person in our town. Spanish was her first language. So she was literally the only Mexican in our town. So they hired her to interpret for this company anyway. So I stayed during the week with this other family. And so during the week, I'm getting molested over and over and over and over. A year and a half goes by. Somehow they manipulated me not telling. I don't know how it really scared me when I had kids. Like, how did they manipulate me not to tell my parents? But either way, they did. A year and a half into it, my dad's out on the road. It's like a Thursday night, maybe a Wednesday night. My mom is home. And I wasn't being babysat that week by those people. Some people came to our house to party, and they would usually party in the kitchen. So my mom is in there partying with a husband and wife. And I'm in a room with some other kids. I'm about 5.5 years old. And there's probably another, you know, a 5-year-old, 6-year-old, whatever, 2 kids. And I began to exhibit sexual behavior with one of these other kids. And I was in a literal sexual act, acting out. Man, I'd been repeatedly molested. I told to do stuff over and over for a year and a half. And I was acting it out. I was doing this with one of these kids. And I initiated it, unfortunately. My mom came to the room and caught me and this other kid in a sexual act. And she lost it. And she started kicking me. And I got up against the wall, the edge of the wall, balled up. And she was kicking me. It was really confusing me because she was mad, but yet she was crying. And, you know, she doesn't know her son has been repeatedly molested. So she thinks I'm a sexual deviant, like there's something wrong with me. And she says, wait till your father comes home. And you're going to have to tell him what I caught you doing. And my dad, super violent person. I can't, you know, I could just tell you a zillion stories. Extremely violent person that liked to beat people up, would go to the bars and just shut. I heard stories, plenty of stories. My dad would go to the bar, lock the door and call at the bar and say, hey, you bunch of blankety blankers, who wants a shot at the title? Just to fight, just because he wanted to fight and hurt people. And I mean, that he would go to bars just to hurt people. They didn't even do anything wrong to him because he just had that hurt inside of him. Yeah. Hurt people, hurt people. He was hurt all his life and he was sharing that hurt with everybody he came into contact with. So anyway, when she said, wait till your dad gets home, I knew it was going to be bad. Because my dad, I mean, we could never have a TV. He would break the TV all the time. He'd rageaholic, he'd bust stuff. And so my dad came home, my mom set me on top of the bed in their house, the house I grew up as a kid there. And there was a wooden door and the kitchen was on the other side of that door. And my mom was scared. My dad would take drugs to stay awake and he'd stay awake a couple of days at a time driving a truck. But then he'd drink like a case of beer and he'd sleep for like 20, 30 hours. So he just got home and he's coming off his high. So he's drinking so he could sleep because he's been up for 2 or 3 days. And that's not a good time. He's pretty violent. I mean, that's a bad time. He's violent and angry usually. And she was afraid to tell him because I remember it was light before she told him. By the time she told him, it was dark. And I heard my dad say, he broke three. He was breaking stuff, table, chairs, kitchen. He destroyed the kitchen. And I heard my dad say about me, I might as well kill that little blankety blank, blank, blanker. And he's going to be a blank, blank, blanker. And he's saying all this bad stuff. And he's going to kill me because of what I'm going to be and what he's projecting that I'm going to be. And laying on top of that bed, Beckett, crying, feeling dirty, knowing that I had done what my mom said I did initiate that. And knowing that the yuck of all the yuck that was on me from being molested over and over, thought popped into my head of what that Sunday school teacher said, that Jesus protects kids. So I'm laying on the bed, a skeptic, a doubting Thomas laying on the bed. I said, Jesus, if you're real, prove it. Come and hug me like you did the kids in the story if you're real. I got picked up off the bed. I was wrapped in arms. And in my house, we didn't get touched. We didn't get hugged. We didn't get loved. And I craved it. In fact, I still crave it. It's been an issue my whole life, even as an adult. And I wanted hugged. And I said, if you're real, hug me. And I got picked up off the bed and I was given a for real physical hug, but it was liquid love, man. It was love on the inside. It was love on the outside. It made the dirtiness and all that sexual shame and guilt come off of me. And right there, I knew just what you said, you're real. And I woke up the next morning. My dad never came out of the room. Nothing ever happened to me. The sun coming through the window woke me up. And the first thought in my mind was this Jesus thing. There's something to this Jesus thing. Because I said, Jesus, if you're real, hug me. And he hugged me. So there it is. So for me, that was it, man.
And how old were you when this happened?
5 and a half. But I never told a single person until I'm dating an atheist bartender. And we get in an argument about God. And I said, look, I know God's real. And she's like, no, he's not. No, he's not. And 6 hours. For 6 hours, we argued about it. And she wore me down. And finally, I said, look, because I never told anybody. I said, look, if I tell you the real reason why I know God's real, you shut up. And I don't want to ever talk about it again. I was selling drugs at the time. I mean, I'm partying wide open, selling coke, selling pot, drunk, living wild, right? And I don't want to talk about God. I don't want to talk about God. And I don't go to church. I don't want to talk about it. Yeah, he's real, but I knew he was real. And in my mind, unfortunately, I'd made him a 911 God. And I only reached out to him when things really got bad. That's just how I lived my life for all those. I knew he was real from when I was 5, but I didn't have anybody tell him about him. In fact, I have to be honest and say I've struggled with anger at God because he showed up and showed me he's real, but there I was still in that crap hole. It's like, where'd you go? You left me here. And so yeah. I've struggled with God and his goodness and why he allows bad things to happen to little kids. I've struggled with that my whole life. But
Did you ever tell your parents? And were they like freaked out when they found out that?
My parents got divorced. I don't know. My mom, she said, I can't believe you remember that night about when they had caught me in the sexual act and stuff. She thought I was too little to remember all that. And she had no idea that Jesus showed up in the room, you know, on the other side of the door. My dad was out there breaking stuff, but yeah.
Wow.
So again, life is messy, man. And it's easy to get mad at God if we blame him for the bad things, but he says good things come from him. And the bad things come from the devil. And we got to just keep that in our head, but it's hard. You know, it's not always easy to think clearly.
Yeah. And I totally get that feeling of, because I was molested too when I was, I think I was 9 years old by a friend's father in the middle of the night. And I've always felt that kind of like, I just like, I'm always like, God, just give me, like, give me a hug. Like, I need that feeling of security. Because I mean, it was the most terrifying thing that happened because I thought he was going to kill me if he knew that I was awake. So yeah, I feel that same kind of, I still to this day feel that to a certain extent of like, I need, you know,
I do too.
Security.
I do too. And you know what? I've talked to other people that have, like us, were sexually abused as children and they feel the same way. I've talked to a lot of people who that's a common denominator.
Yeah. Yeah. It's just,
and again, it's probably just deep psychological wounding.
Yeah.
You know, wounding of our soul by the enemy and people who are sexually abused, I don't, maybe not you, but I deal with anger and I just different stuff, man.
Yeah.
And it's like when you talk to other people, it's like, wow, I guess I thought I was the only one in the world that dealt with all this, but then you talk to them.
Yeah.
Like,
I mean, most of it is for me is anxiety. I deal with anxiety more than anger, which is probably related somehow, but yeah.
You know what I've come to? I think they're just like the polar opposite of each other, but they're connected.
Yeah.
Because it could swing from anger to fear so easy for me in my own life. I see it, man. I feel like they're connected for me.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So how often do you go around? How often do you speak in other places?
Well, pre-COVID, 170 times a year.
Wow.
And then now since COVID, maybe like 50, 60, like a third. I'm at a third of what I used to be pre-COVID, which has been good because honestly, the last 3 years, God's been trying to work on me like that on anxiety stuff and deep-seated woundedness from childhood. Mm-hmm. God, even though I was in ministry and just going wide open and doing stuff, and really we were seeing God heal a bunch of people and do a bunch of stuff, but I, you know, still carrying in gear. I'm convinced God doesn't want us living wounded, and he's weeding my garden. The last 3 years, he's been weeding my garden, getting some of those weeds out of there and trying to get the woundedness out of me. It's not been pretty. It's not been fun. It's been painful, but I do feel like I'm coming out on the other side of it, and I feel like I'm in a probably a better place than I've ever been.
Good. Praise God.
You know?
Well, Bruce, if you ever come out to LA to speak, let me know. And thank you so much for sharing your story. It's amazing. And it's just like just another testament to that God is real. Jesus is real. And this is not like some fantasy. It's a reality.
Right.
And so thank you so much for coming on. I appreciate it.
Thanks for having me on the show. I appreciate it.
Thank you for listening to this episode of The Beckett Cook Show. Your support makes this content possible. All episodes of The Beckett Cook Show are also available on YouTube. For more information about Beckett and his ministry, visit his website at beckettcook.com.
Thank you to the team at Life Audio for their partnership with us. If you go to lifeaudio.com, you will find more faith-centered podcasts about prayer, Bible study, parenting, and more.
Hi, friend. Are you stressed, maybe even worried about so many needs around you that you've forgotten you are worth taking care of too? Well, I'm Bonnie Gray, the host of Breathe, the Stressless Podcast. I want to invite you to join me as I share practical tips based on science, inspired by God's Word, to help you spark joy and restore God's peace and love to your soul. Subscribe now and go to lifeaudio.com.